Well, sometimes people seem to approach religious scriptures as if they're, you can sum everything up in two words. So the Old Testament would be God punishes. New Testament would be Jesus saves. And that's about as complicated as everyone poops. But, you know, I think it's a little bit too simple. I think we can keep going back and finding more and more every time. The Bible's Book of Judges that we had a class on last year was probably edited into shape when there was really no Israel to speak of, when all of its leading families were living in exile and feeling powerless in a strange land. No doubt, they hungered to turn the tables on those who ruled their lives. So the first story in the book would have felt very satisfying. We imagine ourselves back in time in our own promised land. Now our hero comes to subdue the aliens there, which is how we think of the land's original inhabitants. Maybe if we'd eliminated them back then, we wouldn't be in alien hands now. After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, asking, "Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight them?" The Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Behold, I've given the land into his hand." And Judah said to Simeon, his brother, "Come with me into the territory allotted to me that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I likewise will go with you into the territory allotted to you." So Simeon went with him. Then Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hands, and they defeated 10,000 of them at Bezek, cleared the land of those people. So now they move on to the next ones. They came upon the king, Adoni-Bezek, at Bezek, and fought against him, and defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Adoni-Bezek fled, but they pursued him and caught him, and cut off his thumbs and big toes. And Adoni-Bezek said, very calmly, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to pick up scraps under my table, as I have done. So God has requited me. And they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. That's how he slips out of it. But let's not let the story itself get away so easily. Movies today, with their computer-generated imagery, do a lot of our imagining for us. Sometimes now it's in 3D. But I invite you to go back in time in your minds, like the Israelites did, and take a more active part in imagining that king under the table. What would it be like to try to walk without your big toes? You can remain seated for now and try this later. But how about those thumbs? Let's try this in real 3D. Maybe you'd like to bend down and untie one of your shoes and then tie it again without using your thumbs. Or if bending is a problem, you could just undo a button and then redo it. But no thumbs, please. Try. I know. Look at this. Your mothers dress you so it's easy, don't they? Almost everyone has pullover clothes on. Do you have Velcro straps on your shoes too? Anyway, well, how was that? How did that go? Now, even if you could manage to do it, imagine what it would be like to try while everyone else was watching you instead of trying to do the same things themselves. How would that feel? Well, how about we do something easier instead, like singing? Let's sing to rise in body or spirit and sing together hymn number 6, "Just As Long As I Have Breath." Number 6. Cutting off someone's big toes and thumbs is a great way to not only hurt them, but also to humiliate them, to deprive them of an essential part of their physical humanity. Adoni-Bezek, that king, understands this as well as his captors, and he makes no bones about the fact that he would have done the same to them if he'd won the battle, like he did to, quote, 70 kings who used to pick up scraps under my table. That's what dogs do, or other house pets, shuffling around down below where you and your guests are seated. Dogs don't have thumbs. People do. Or we could say that people have thumbs, but dogs don't. One king made the other kings live like dogs, but now the table has been turned, and it's his turn below. Fair play, he says, doesn't cry foul. But see what you think about this next story. The tables have turned again. Israel, so far, is just the Bible's name for a loose confederation of tribes, not a real kingdom or nation yet among the others in the area. But now, Eglon, king of Moab, has gathered a new alliance of Ammonites and Amalekites against these Israelite tribes. And he went and defeated Israel. And they took possession of the city of palms, and the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. But when the people of Israel cried to the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, a left-handed man. Remember that detail. The people of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab, and Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubit, about 18 inches in length, and he girded it on his right thigh under his clothes. And he presented the tribute to Eglon, the king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. In fact, his name comes from a word meaning round. So it could signify something like fatted calf, or maybe just roundy. In the original language, Ehud the hero is referred to as a man impaired in his right hand, which makes him a lefty by default, if not by birth. And when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people that carried the tribute. But he himself turned back at the sculptured stones near Gilgal and said, "I have a secret message for you, king." And the king commanded, "Silence." And all his attendants went out from his presence. This leaves Roundy and Lefty all alone together. Everything's quiet. What's the secret message going to be? Wouldn't you like to know? Eglon would, but it's going to cost him. And Ehud came to him as he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, "I have a message from God for you." And Eglon arose from his seat. Do you know how the king thing works when it comes to who sits and who stands? How? Right? Yeah. He sits, you stand. He's at rest, you're at the ready. Ready to serve, to supplicate, to do a little dance if he wants one, or to leave when he tells you. So it's really something for the round king to raise his royal bulk off the throne and hear what Ehud has to say. Ehud's God might not be the king's God, but he wishes to show his respect. Nevertheless, there's a measure of goodwill on his part, as well as that measure of great body weight. "Your God has a message for me? I'm honored." And Ehud reached his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into Eglon's belly. And the hilt also went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the sword out of his belly, and the dirt came out. Then Ehud went into the vestibule and closed the doors of the roof chamber upon him and locked them. Now, most people wore their sword on the left side so they could draw it with their right hand, ready to salute or slash or stab, depending on the situation. Do you want to try it? While you sit or stand, imagine that you're trying to draw a sword from your right side with your right hand. Okay, think of the short sword, just 18 inches. A little awkward. Don't bop your neighbors. So Now try drawing it from your left side. That's how it's done. Much better, right? Left, right? So most people would have hidden their sword on the left side. That's where the guards would have expected it during the pat-down, I guess. But Ehud got a short one past them, hidden on his right. Now he draws it with his left hand and surprise. Gotcha, Eglon, you big round joke, you. Imagine the Israelites laughing as they heard this story. Lefty's sword just disappeared, point blade, hilt and all, and fat old roundy's fat old belly. It never came out at all. But something else did. And I don't think it was the groundhog coming out of his hole. What do you think the earthy Hebrew said that's translated into English as the dirt came out? They didn't pull any punches in that biblical Hebrew language. Well, another way to answer that question is, why do we put diapers on prisoners before executions? What might happen to anyone whose body takes a sudden trauma? Just to make sure we get it, the Bible rubs it in, so to speak. Take a sip of water after that. When he had gone, the servants came, and when they saw that the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought, he's only covering his feet in the closet of the cool chamber. To cover one's feet is a Hebrew euphemism for the English euphemism to relieve oneself, which means to take an aspirin, right? No? And they waited till they were utterly at a loss, but when he still did not open the doors of the roof chamber, they took the key and opened them, and there lay their Lord, dead on the floor. What a mess. And what a laugh, right? The story must have been enormously satisfying for people who were struggling with their own feelings of defeat and humiliation, of being small, incompetent, and weak. I get it. I enjoy a good poop joke as much as the next person, but I think it's also important to try to think about why these are so entertaining, both now and in the past, and for people the whole world round. What's so funny about the round king's fall from dignity to that cool, messy floor? Well, part of the power of that sweet little children's book, Everyone Poops, is that not everyone knows this fact at first. Maybe no one does. It's easy to think you're the only one and to feel all alone in your struggle to become a big boy or a big girl. If opposing thumbs are part of what makes us physically human, our social humanity is wrapped up with getting that stuff right. Once we do, we never quite get over the fear of getting it wrong again. We carry the potential for humiliation with us at all times. It's not that that stuff is who we really are, or even part of us exactly, but it's close. So close, inside out. What is a normal and natural part of life can become a social disaster when it emerges just a few seconds off or just a few inches away from when and where we intend it to, especially if it happens in public. Decades of personal achievement and carefully constructed identity can be reduced in an instant to just one thing that comes out at the wrong moment. And that's the first thing you'll be remembered for until the last time you're ever remembered. Or at least, it feels that way. We're scared that people will think the number one thing about you is the time you went number two. Okay, let's get back to the story. It races to its conclusion as Ehud races around the countryside, gathering a militia. Some drive the Moabites out of the city. Others race ahead to seize the fords of the Jordan to hold against their enemies. They kill 10,000, and the land enjoys peace for 80 years. Sound the trumpets, hip hooray, the end. It becomes a story like so many others. dealing out humiliation and defeat to one party and glory to the other. Entertaining while it lasts and essentially forgettable. I don't know about you, but I'm getting bored with the same old story of trading humiliation back and forth, one side looking for good ways to get the drop on the other, going down and dirty, and then we pick our leaders out of this mess. The really interesting part of the story for me, the really unusual part, the really, really strange part, is when the king rises to his feet instead of holding on to his seat to show his power. He stands as an equal for just a moment with this stranger who says he's brought a message from God. A word that stinks like you know what. To many people, I know, and often for good reason. So let's call it instead a communication of some greater good that arches over kings and subjects or the struggles of my people with yours. What's the word from this greater good? There is none really. It was a ruse. But the possibility of it came so close. And then the potential for dialogue, for compassion, ends. It was only really there for a brief moment. The story is what it is. I've heard that some parents were so upset by the deaths of certain characters in the Harry Potter books. You know those books? That they wrote and self-published alternative versions for their kids, in which those characters survive. And they've even done them complete with illustrated covers. I've seen one. It's an interesting choice. But I won't ask the story of Lefty the hero and Roundy the king to be a different story than it is. Still, there's a small ray of light that comes through it by which we can keep reading. And what do we find if we do? Let's look way ahead into the first book of Samuel, where we find Saul, the first real king of a real Israel, pursuing David, the shepherd's son, who's long been the king's golden boy. Like Ehud, David had defeated his people's plus-size opponent. Remember who that was? Goliath, dropping that giant Goliath with a stone from his sling. Pow! Right in the forehead. Saul had made David his harp player, his attendant, and his right-hand man. There's no lefties in this story. But then while returning to the city after a battle, Saul heard the women singing a song with the line, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s." Saul is thousands, David is 10,000s. Ouch! This does not sit well with the king. He is supposed to be the guy who the ladies swoon for, the man in first place, not number one, not number two, and surely not one-tenth. Yay for the king, he's number 0.1. The next day, he tries to spear David while he's playing the harp. David escapes. They reconcile, but the king's violent mood swings continue, and David is never really safe. On the downside of one of these cycles, David has fled from Saul into the wild hills of the countryside, safe for a while, but then someone tells the king where the young man is hiding. Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men and went to seek David and his men in front of the Wild Goats Rocks. I love that. Wild Goats Rocks. And he came to the sheepfolds, by the way, where there was a cave. And Saul went in to cover his feet, which means he went in to take an aspirin, right? No, it's something else, something that most of us prefer to do in private, isn't it? Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of that cave. And the men of David said to him, "Here's the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I'll give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as shall seem good to you." Then David rose and stealthily cut off the skirt of Saul's robe. He could hardly have had the king in a more vulnerable position. I can't think of one. Can you? Close. Really close. David's men want him to finish the job and kill the king, but he is filled with remorse. Once Saul has finished and uncovered his feet, I guess you say, he stands up and steps out of the cave to where his soldiers are waiting. But before they can leave, David comes out into the light and calls to Saul, "My lord, the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed and said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the people who say David seeks to harm you? This day your eyes have seen how God gave you into my hand in the cave, and someone bade me kill you, but I spared you. See, my father, see the skirt of your robe in my hand, for by the fact that I cut off the skirt of your robe and did not kill you, you know and see there's no wrong or treason in my hands. I've not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it." When David finished speaking, Saul said, "Is that your voice, my son David?" And Saul lifted up his voice and wept, pooping and crying, and a king. Remember that other king? Adoni Bezek, picking up scraps under the table with no big toes or thumbs. He doesn't complain because he's put plenty of others in that same position. And this is the key to understanding David and Saul at the mouth of the cave. David can imagine himself in Saul's position. Not as a king, that's coming later, but rather as a human being, sharing with Saul a feature of bodily life that he shares with everyone. With everyone. It's funny how those moments that feel most private are those we really share with everyone else. Kings, elephants, birds, fish, and butterflies. Our moments most alone can be our moments most together, if we understand. How about that? Even when we're covering our feet, it can be a time to remember our connections and find compassion. Well, thank you for your kind attention. I know this has been kind of a poopy sermon today. And you may feel relieved to know that it's over. But wait, this just in. As I was sketching out the draft of this sermon, a news story broke with the headlines, "Fecal Implant Saves Woman's Life." I laughed at first, thinking it must have been the misprint of all time for what should have been fetal implant with a T, not a C, even though I couldn't imagine what that meant. And then I read the story about a young woman who had been in a terrible car crash that, quote, fractured her lower spine, lacerated her liver and colon, and broke all 10 toes, leaving her much more broken apart than those ancient kings, Adoni Bezek, Eglon, and Saul put together. Fortunately, she had modern medicine and prompt care that pulled her through at first. However, a combination of organ damage plus large doses of antibiotics had led to a terrible intestinal infection called Clostridium difficile. Standing 5'7", right, when she could manage to stand, her weight fell to 85 pounds, and she was near death. Then doctors performed an amazing, though little-known procedure, transferring some material from her mother's gut to hers. It turned out that this stuff, far from being simply waste, can also be thought of as something like a precious sourdough starter, the kind that you share or pass down across generations. We often think of it as an end product, but this starter saved her life. Parents and grandparents, aren't you glad I didn't try to explain something like this to the kids this morning while reading Everyone Poops? But still, isn't it something? So much more than we often think it is. What a good day to remember this. On the number 2 day of the number 2 month of the year, that blessings can be found in the darkest, most unexpected places, either covering our feet or somewhere down beneath them. Of course, I'm talking about the groundhog. May we always be willing to look and to see what we find.